because they sell the righteous for silver. They sell the needy for a pair of sandals. It's that concrete imagery that will really grab. They trample the heads of the poor into the dust of the earth, and they push the afflicted out of the way. That's the power of his rhetoric, and he's got you right there. Amos does not use some of those key cultic terms we've seen before, such as Berit covenant or even Torah. Nevertheless, he does anchor his pronouncements in the covenant community's history. For example, this is Amos 3, chapter 3, verse 1. Hear this word that the Lord has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the family which I brought out of Egypt. So just as we find in the law codes that Egyptian experience, freedom from slavery becomes the model by which morality is ensured, it also becomes the paradigm, the template, by which the prophets express their own concerns about the covenant community's responsibilities. Although, as Amos points out, the community was rescued by God, the community doesn't heed that rescue and thereby in effect enslaves other people. They repeat history, but here they are in the role of Pharaoh rather than in the role of the oppressed. How else does Amos get his views across? He actually uses a technique we know from divining, to go back to that earlier version of technical prophecy. Part of divining is to look out and see something, and in that thing that you see, get a message. As if today you would go outside and you would see a bird sitting where you had not seen a bird before, and you take it as a positive omen or a negative omen if it's on your windshield. Amos can do exactly the same thing. Here's an example. And the reason this is so compelling is not only because he uses perfectly normal objects, but he enhances his view of something that's perfectly normal with puns. And the problem here is we miss the puns in English translation. Thus the Lord God showed me, and behold, a basket of summer fruit, something that anybody could find. And he said, Amos, what do you see? And I said, I see a basket of summer fruit. The Hebrew for summer fruit is kayetz. And the Lord said to me, the end, kates, shall come upon my people Israel, from kayetz, summer fruits, to kates. And the people would have heard the harshness even of those expressions, those hard K sounds. And they would remember every time they picked up a basket of summer fruits. Amos also plays upon the people's expectations only to reverse them. All cultures have rhetorical expectations. If somebody begins the Star Spangled Banner, we pretty much know how it's going to end, right? If somebody begins a cultic liturgy, a creed, for example, or a familiar prayer in church or synagogue, we know how it's going to end. The people in ancient Israel knew the same. For example, in cultic settings, they would talk about the day of the Lord, something to expect when God's righteousness would become fully manifest. And they would say, the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord. And Amos picks up on it, the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord. But then he goes on to say, it is darkness and not light, totally changing their expectations of what they might have expected. He also invokes material that sounds very much like the curses we find at the end of Deuteronomy. And we might think back here to those suzerainty vassal treaties that end with a series of blessings if you do what the suzerain wants, and end with a series of curses if you disobey the suzerain's commands. I withheld the rain from you. I smote you with blight and mildew. I sent among you a pestilence after the manner of Egypt. It sounds like the end of Deuteronomy. It's actually Amos chapter 4. And I think the people would have recognized this particular litany of curses as stemming directly from those suzerainty vassal treaties. They would have recognized the covenant connections even in the words. In addition to cultic language and treaty language, Amos also invokes rhetoric from schools of wisdom. We'll experience wisdom later. Well, we've already experienced wisdom, but we'll experience wisdom literature later when we get to books such as Proverbs and Job. But the wisdom school itself had a particular form of rhetoric. They would, for example, ask rhetorical questions. For example, do two walk together unless they've got an appointment? Does a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Does a young lion cry out from its den if it has caught nothing? My students frequently add, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there, can you hear that? Amos does not say that. But these rhetorical questions go on. is a trumpet blown in the city and the people are not afraid. That's getting a little bit closer.